Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Into the 7 o'clock hour we go. Payne and Pendergast with you, Sports Radio 610. I'm Sean Pendergast. He is Seth Payne. And Seth, the mayor, boy, when I heard about this, I was like, okay, is this a joke that somebody's making here, that we're actually doing this here when it comes to businesses that might be violating COVID guidelines? But no, the mayor, Sylvester Turner, announced that the city is going to have a mythical wall of shame, a figurative wall of shame for businesses that are violating the parameters, the guidelines set forth to prevent the spread of the coronavirus. And yesterday on Twitter, he announced the first three additions to the city's wall of shame, collection of businesses that are not following these guidelines. He announced that three Houston bars are the first establishments on his wall of shame, including downtown nightclub Spire, which inspired criticism after photos of a packed house from over the weekend surfaced on social media. Prospect Park also added to the list, along with Poor Behavior, which is at 2211 Travis Street. So three bars in the area here. I think Prospect Park is over by the Galleria. I think we've done shows there before, station events there before, over like Fountain View, Richmond, kind of that area over there. These three bars, which, you know, there's one way that I feel about this, which is if you're sending in pictures somewhere where you're basically narking out businesses, I don't know how I feel about that. Conversely, though, in a day and age where everything winds up on social media, especially gatherings at bars, you got to be pretty stupid to own one of these places and let in capacity over what you're supposed to have in there. Or even, you know, I don't even know if some of these places are even supposed to be open, with the guidelines being that most, you know, majority of your business needs to come from food right now to even be open. Bars are closed right now.
I don't know. Sean, look, this is the city of Marvin Zindler. This is the city of slime in the ice machine. Mm-hmm. For you youngsters, Marvin Zindler, and Ben, I just emailed you a Marvin Zindler link. I need you to get ready for air so some of the youngsters can appreciate the brilliance of Marvin Zindler. Spectacularly dressed man with interesting eyeglasses who sought out restaurants that weren't abiding by the health code, right? And he would report on slime in the health machine, rats in the kitchen, stuff like that. He would publicly shame.
He had a great tag at the end of his reports, too.
What was it?
Marvin Zindler, Eyewitness News. But continue with your point.
I met his granddaughter on a flight once, and I was kind of disappointed that she was just had a normal personality. She's very just a very pleasant normal.
Didn't even wear glasses that were blue or anything like that. So Zindler was basically he was the guy who would go find these businesses that were violating health codes.
Can you imagine if we had Zindler around right now in the time of the coronavirus? Man. He would have been out. He would have been at these clubs. He would have been in the middle of the dance floor wearing his N95 mask, reporting on the horrible situations.
Do you want to play the Ben? Do we have the audio here? We do. Yeah. Do you want to play it here, Seth? Do you want to toss to?
Let's hear what restaurant he's talking about.
Okay.
Big S. Grisby in the 14,500 block of Grisby. Loretta Taqueria in the 6,900 block of Irvington. Einstein Brothers Bagels in the 10,200 block of Posto. Tapes in the 6,500 block of Westheimer. Prince's in the 8,800 block of Westheimer. And McDonald's in the 12,600 block of Bissonnette. And what did we have? All together, gang.
Not bad.
That was catchy. Slime in the ice machine. Now, to be sure, everybody listening, that was 1999.
Thank you.
All those places, I'm sure, have cleaned up since then.
Right.
I realized that as soon as it started going, oh boy, this is
naming them by name.
That was 21 years ago.
Right.
I would imagine that a lot of those places have either at least changed location and certainly management.
And I would say that now they're probably some of the safest places because, as we know, those become the safest places to go eat once they get a scare
thrown
into them. Slime in the ice machine.
Bow, bow, yeah. Bow.
So you're down with the wall of shame concept. You are down with the.
I'm tolerant of it. I think it's
hilarious.
You know what? I like it better than heavy-handed government punishments or what have you.
Yeah.
And that's where I think that governments are struggling with right now is, okay, how heavy-handed can we be with any of this and not have our citizens rise up in revolt? And I think whether it's public shaming or public encouragement, I would rather go on the side of, like, look, honestly, what Texas needs right now more than anything is a don't mess with Texas style and magnitude of campaign.
Right.
Where littering used to be an issue. This is something that people probably don't remember or choose not to. Littering used to be like no big deal to a lot of people. It was the weirdest thing in the world. People would drive down the road and just be like, here's a Big Mac wrapper, throw it out the window.
Yeah.
Like to the point where every place was their personal trash can. Texas started this, and this is cited in a lot of different like advertising and PR educational material. This Don't Mess with Texas campaign where famous Texans and a lot of athletes encouraged other Texans not to litter, became very, very successful.
Yeah.
So I think likewise, if you have mask campaigns like that, instead of shaming people, but maybe promoting social distancing, a very minimal amount of social distancing, by the way, the amount of effort that it takes to not throw a wrapper out the window is the same amount of effort it takes to put on a mask.
or stay 6 feet away from other human beings.
Yeah. I would rather go that route.
Yeah.
So I would prefer that to just the shaming.
I'll be honest with you, Seth. I'm more concerned that Mayor Turner's coming for our jobs. Man, I don't mean like to put us on a wall of shame or fire us. I mean to literally become a talk radio host. Because the wall of shame feels like something that you and I would make up for sports. Like, I'm afraid Mayor Turner's going to have the Mount Rushmore of businesses tomorrow, the four that have exemplified the most social distancing, and that eventually this is going to lead to him being the morning host on Sports Radio 610. Because he's such a good topic generator.
Are you saying Sylvester Turner is a hack sports radio host?
I'm saying that. There you go. Waka, waka, waka. Jazz hands.
Coming up. No, I'm not ashamed of doing hack sports. Honestly, I think sometimes
either.
We should do more hack sports radio topics. Because you know, this same thing happens in stand-up comedy. You know what hacks do? They kill.
Yeah.
People love them. Crowds love hacks.
Right.
So likewise, our audience would love some of these hack topics,
they
too.
They would. Well,
Jordan versus LeBron. Who you got, Sean?
Oh boy, Jordan versus LeBron would wear me out. But the wall of shame thing, you know, because they just put a Houston Sports Hall of Fame in like 3 years. We've had three classes, I think, of Hall of Famers for Houston, and they put that walk in over downtown in that in the area right over where AT&T Sports Network CSN used to be. I forget what they call that little area over there, but they've got someone will text in 713-572-4610. It's really nice. They've got the almost like the Walk of Fame in Hollywood where all the Hall of Famers have their piece of the sidewalk there where they've autographed it and so forth. They should take the sidewalk like next one over that goes by the dumpster in between the two parking lots and make that the Houston Sports Wall of Shame where they can put people like Brock Osweiler.
You could put like a trough style latrine in there.
Wrigley Field.
Yeah, but have it just be sure it's on the floor, not even waist level. Like you want splatter to hit your shoes and remind you of just what the Brock Osweiler years were like.
And that's where his plaque would be inside the trough urinal. So you could pick most hated Houston athlete you actually want to go urinate on. Their plaque, not them personally, but their plaque. Like, you know what? I think I'm gonna walk over to the Ed Reed plaque over here.
That's a good, Ed Reed should be on there.
Yeah.
Chandler Parsons should be there, which is a shame because he was very well liked when he was here. But then as soon as he left, he acted like Daryl Morey giving him the opportunity to make way more money than he was worth was like a bad thing.
Right.
He said that the city of Houston stinks, took other shots at them. So he's on the, he earned his way into the wall of shame.
Who else would you, that, I mean, you know, if we're putting an inaugural class together, those are three pretty good names to start with, I would say.
I think Amon Green is up there in a lot of people's minds.
Yeah.
Now these numbers, it's funny how much numbers have changed in the past 15 years or so. But okay, Texans gave him a 4-year, $23 million deal, which was a big deal for an aging running back back then.
That's not even Eric Murray money now.
He rushed for 260 yards and two touchdowns in 2007. The next year, he rushed for 294 yards and had three touchdowns. More notably, Sean, and this is, I'll give the NFL some credit for understanding and fixing the way they talk about domestic violence and whatnot, because Amon Green had several incidents, several incidents through the years. And I found this article from right after he had left the Texans, so it would have been like around 2010 or so.
Yep.
And in this article, it describes like these issues, these domestic violence incidents as, quote, family strife and, quote, emotional turmoil within his family.
Yeah.
It never once, and it paints a very almost just a sympathetic figure in Amon Green. Like, oh, it sounds like he's had a hard time with his daughters. That's a shame.
Seth, this is a true story. Right around that same time, right around 2010, 2011, Amon Green had gone from the NFL to the CFL. I forget what team he was playing for, but he, you know, and for a running back who's in his early 30s, that's clearly like last legs kind of thing. Like you're just hanging on either because you love football or you need the money. One of the two. Maybe both. And he got cut by whatever CFL team he was on. So I wrote a snarky post in the Houston Press about it, as I am wont to do from time to time. And he must Google his name. I mean, this was like before Twitter became a really big platform. And he found the article and he reached out and emailed me and emailed me, not irate, not irrational, but basically telling me, hey, man, you don't know the whole story and you're writing these sarcastic things about me, that kind of thing. So he came on my radio show over at 1560 over there.
Well, the article I was reading, he was talking about how, like, well, there was a lot going on in Houston. It was more than just the injuries. I was distracted and everything. Yeah. You know, yeah, I don't, you've got, like, you're, it's on record going back years.
Right.
The issues that you've had. And it continued on after he was done in Houston.
Oh,
you know what, Sean? Yeah, I got to remember, though. A lot of times these guys just have stuff forwarded to them by like well-meaning fans.
Yeah, that's true.
That think like, oh, I'm going to do show or people just trying to mix it up.
Yeah.
I never assume that people are Googling themselves because guys get forwarded stuff all the time. You write something snarky about DeAndre Hopkins, 10 different people like forward that to DeAndre and they think they're doing DeAndre a solid.
Seth,
so DeAndre can like be, so DeAndre can get irked or something like that. That's doing him a favor.
The names are rolling in on the text line for the Houston Sports Hall of Show.
Oh yeah, who we got?
I'll read a couple of them now and we'll save a couple for the next segment. Mike Fiers is multiple people have texted in Mike Fiers.
Of course. No hitter Mike Fiers.
The Houston Sports Hall of Shame. Ken Giles is getting some love on here as well. And really, it's a lot of Astros. Carlos Gomez. Remember Carlos Gomez? They brought over in a trade.
Let's go through this Hall of Shame next. Yeah.
Okay, so we'll go through some of these names. The Houston Sports Hall of Shame. We're putting it right next to Mayor Turner's Business Hall of Shame. So we'll go through some of these. And also, can Josh McDaniels unlock the best Cam Newton that we've seen? We'll get into that as well. It's next. He said, slime in the ass machine. We will get to your Hall of Shame nominees in just a second for the Houston Sports Hall of Shame. In the spirit of the mayor creating a wall of shame for businesses that are violating COVID parameters, Booger McFarland discussed Cam Newton yesterday on Ross Tucker's podcast and had this to say about Cam Newton going to New England.
Have we seen him make unscripted moves? Have we seen him take hits? Let's not forget, it's a foot and a shoulder. And if you told me that Cam Newton is not going to run the football and not going to be that physically imposing specimen that we've seen, I would tell you I don't want it. Because I don't see a guy that can become a drop-back passer. And everybody's going to go back to 2018 with North Turner. Cam Newton completed 68% of his passes. Hey, stats lie sometimes. Those were a lot of check-down passes. If you go back and you look at his completion percentage, 15 to 20 yards down the field, it was still in line with where he's been his entire career, which is a 50 to 55% passer. And that just doesn't cut it in an NFL where most quarterbacks are around 65, 68% completion percentage.
I don't disagree with anything Booger said right there. And I thought the stats he brought up there, Seth, to get underneath the completion percentage, which I cited yesterday in those first eight games of 2018, is a, hey, that's, you know, that's an encouraging thing right there. That was a stat that, man, he was in the MVP conversation until his body started to fall apart. I respect Booger for bringing the stats there, assuming they're true, that maybe the completion percentage was a little fugazi. But just because Cam may not be able to turn into that guy at this stage of his career doesn't mean that the Patriots can't get a great version of a healthy Cam Newton. Do you think that with Josh McDaniels constructing this offense, Seth, and with Bill Belichick as a head coach, there's a chance that we, if healthy, could see a Cam Newton that approaches what he was in 2015, or maybe the most efficient version of Cam that we've seen?
Yeah, well, yeah, I think, of course, there's a 100% chance, because what Booger started out with was it's a foot and a shoulder. So, I mean, Booger was rolling, like acting like his foot and his shoulder are going to be the exact same state they've been in the last 2 years, where obviously the Patriots are hoping that he's not. But the Patriots risk nothing here. This is such a low-risk move. This is all on Cam in terms of Cam saying, yep, I'm going to go. I'm going to compete for a spot with one of the best coaches of all time. And maybe, and then who knows, maybe New England will put their illicit spying techniques to work on me, and I'll look even that much better. And there's no downside here. I'm failing to see. This is a little bit like when people thought there was a downside to signing Carmelo Anthony. There was, in terms of, okay, him gumming things up for the first few weeks until you realized he wasn't going to work. But Carmelo was on a $2 million deal. This is even less than that. So New England risks nothing. If it doesn't work out with Cam, they just go back to Jarrett Stidham, who already knows the system, who's already been there. They lose very little time. And the upside is, okay, Cam might have five more years left in him, and the Patriots will have first crack at him if things are working out.
What do you think Josh McDaniels' excitement level is right now over maybe doing some different things than he's been doing the last few years as the play caller?
I think like the same way Brady's probably feeling a certain reinvigoration.
Yeah.
Because everything gets stale after a while. Mm-hmm. You know, everything gets a little old. Everybody farts. You just, everybody loses their charm a little bit.
Right.
So I think that Josh McDaniels is probably excited. I think that Booger McFarland overstates how much checking down Cam Newton's game was in 2018 versus how much it was just the quick hitting passing game.
Gotcha.
In the quick hitting passing game, the quick hitting passing game works really well with mobile quarterbacks who can work the play action and the quarterback read option, all that stuff. It works really well. And then if defenses decide to take away that, then it opens up things downfield. The nice thing about all the modern zone read stuff and the RPOs is that it's almost just, it's an advancement of play action where ultimately what you're going to do is open up stuff downfield. They're going to, just like they have to come up and stop the run, now they also have to come up and stop the quick hitting passing game. And if you can get the protections right, that opens up opportunities downfield. So I disagree with Booger there that it was check downs. There's a difference between a check down and just a quick pass.
So Seth and I, in the spirit of Mayor Turner's wall of shame for ne'er-do-well businesses violating COVID guidelines, we suggested a Houston sports wall of shame, and the texts are rolling in. Mike Fiers said that if there's an inaugural class, I would say Mike Fiers has enough support across the text page to be maybe the marquee face on the inaugural wall of shame.
Whatever the equivalent is to taking a home run ball from the opponent's team and throwing it back onto the field.
Yeah.
That's what it feels like people are doing with the Mike Fiers no-hitter. They're throwing that no-hitter back onto the field.
Yeah.
They don't want anything to do with it. It's people will always look at that. They're going to look at that no-hitter with a little bit of an asterisk.
Mm-hmm. Carlos Gomez getting a lot of love. Kelvin Cato.
Oh, Gomez. I miss Gomez swinging out of his shoes.
Yeah.
I miss Gomez refusing to acknowledge that he played better with his glasses on than off. I miss all those things about Carlos Gomez. Colin McHugh just saying what the bleep to Gomez letting one drop in the outfield.
Oh, yeah. Carlos Lee getting a lot of love. Carlos Lee, who signed one of the biggest deals in baseball and then just became a very fat left fielder. A very fat, but not completely unproductive left fielder for the Astros. You know, he had a lot of very empty 30 home run and 100 RBI seasons for some very mediocre Astro teams, I will point out. So, yeah, Carlos Lee getting a lot of love. Phil Nevin getting a lot of love because they could have drafted Derek Jeter instead.
Tony Baselli, a lot of people just not big fan. Yeah, and there's more to the picture, you know. Like Tony Baselli did nothing to this franchise. Mm-hmm. They drafted him knowing he had a shoulder issue. They had to spend a certain amount of money anyway, so they could have either taken Tony Baselli or 20 other dudes that weren't going to make it in the NFL in general, much less with the Texans. And it just didn't work out. He never got healthy, but he worked his ass off.
I'm surprised it took this long for Bill O'Brien to get a mention from somebody on a wall. I don't know that he's wall of shame. Like, the wall of shame are like cataclysmic, like soul-crushing moment or horrible contract kind of things. But, I mean, there are some people that feel that way about Bill O'Brien. So we got a Bill O'Brien text. And Seth, I was thinking yesterday when we were talking about Houston's storylines in sports the last few years that went national. One of the ones that we left out relative to O'Brien was the TMZ getting the video of him yelling at the fan in the Denver game. We didn't mention that one yesterday.
That was
a national storyline. O'Brien shouting down the fan at the Denver game.
You're right. And I'm thinking, though, that wouldn't be a Hall of Shame moment. At the time, the majority of Texans fans actually approved of that.
68%.
They actually liked him showing that amount of fire.
Yeah.
But then immediately after the Kansas City game, they all changed their opinion.
Someone just texted a name that I had put on the rundown, Royce White. How did it take this long for Royce White to get a mention?
Well, and Royce White, Royce White has his anxiety issues, which are real, but he also has the part of him that kind of painted an inaccurate picture of the way it went down with the Rockets, where the Rockets were bending over backwards to try to figure out how to work with him, and he just wouldn't tell them what he needed.
Right.
He would say, "We need a protocol," and the Rockets would say, "Well, okay, we haven't had any guidance from you. You haven't told us what you need. I need a protocol."
Yeah.
And now I still see Royce White introduced as a guy who lost his job with the Rockets because of his anxiety disorder. No. He lost his job because he couldn't stop talking smack with the team that drafted him in the first round, knowing that they would want to work with him on his anxiety disorder.
Yeah.
So that part of Royce White, not the total human being, but the part of them that misrepresented what exactly was going on in Houston.
He went on HBO Real Sports and spent the whole feature in a robe, clearly overweight, walking around his house. You know what I mean? Like he wasn't shown working out, trying to get ready to play basketball. He was in a robe, like 30 pounds overweight. I mean, Royce White. Scottie Pippen getting some love on
but
here.
But that's the biggest thing. I mean, the Rockets knew that they were going to have to come up with ways to work around his anxiety disorder. And they were going out of their way. They drafted him in the first round knowing that.
Yeah, of course.
And they tried to get this protocol because they knew there was going to have to be a protocol, and they didn't get any help from Royce White on that part. And it just got to be the point where it felt like the Rockets were almost being used as a publicity tool.
Speaking of Bill O'Brien, should the criticism of one of O'Brien's most controversial trades shift from the Texans over to the Texans' trade partner? That's next. Sean Pendergast, Seth Payne with you. We talked about Jadeveon Clowney yesterday. Here is Tony Pauline on Jadeveon Clowney. Covers the NFL draft, covers the NFL in general. Here's Tony Pauline on ESPN San Antonio talking about Jadeveon Clowney and where he might sign.
Look for a one-year deal with a team that's going to be competitive, that can make a competitive push through the playoffs. And his, on top of his wish list, well, what I was told from somebody in his camp is the New Orleans Saints as well as the Dallas Cowboys.
Tony, you reported on Jamal Adams as well, and we'll get to that. But, I mean, why do you think it is? I mean, obviously you can't speak for either Jamal or for Clowney, but why is it that the Cowboys are seemingly at the center or the top or near the top of either of these players' wish lists? Is it the Cowboys brand? Is it unique reasoning? I mean, what is it?
Well, I mean, with Jamal Adams, he's always been a Cowboys fan. I think with Jadeveon Clowney, you know, I think he'd like nothing more than to return to Dallas and kind of stick it to the Houston Texans. Who basically had a parting of the ways, especially with the head coach Bill O'Brien. And I think he feels that, you know, if he goes back, if he goes to Dallas and really helps elevate that team and takes them deeper into the playoffs than, say, where the Houston Texans go, I think he'd like nothing more than that.
Seth, so I don't know that I totally agree with the stick it to the Texans thing. And you and I came up with a handful of teams yesterday that would be a bigger middle finger to the Texans if Clowney were to go there than the Dallas Cowboys. I think two teams in division, Titans and Colts, would be a much bigger issue with Bill O'Brien than if he were to go to the Dallas Cowboys, who the Texans face once every 4 years in a game that matters. Are you surprised that Seattle didn't make or hasn't made more of an effort to lock up Clowney? Just, you know, given the fact that they got him for a relative bargain, I guess. I mean, O'Brien was roundly criticized for the return on the deal. But in Seattle, if he doesn't come back, he basically turned into a one-year rental that they got three sacks out of this past season.
Right. And I don't know. I think that they kind of figured that they were – it was almost like they were purchasing an option on Jadeveon Clowney.
Yeah.
But they were only going to spend so much. And it's – I think that they probably had a realistic notion of what his worth was and what they were willing to pay for it. And they made him an offer, right? But just because you spend a third round pick on somebody doesn't mean that you have to offer him exactly what he wants, or $20 million a year or whatever it might be. So they might be disappointed that it didn't work out. But if anything, I guess it's a show of financial restraint that they took a swing on a third rounder to get a guy at a reasonable value, and it didn't work out. Just like 50% of third round picks don't work out in general, they took that chance.
And I guess to be clear, Seattle did not subject itself to the same criticism that the Texans did in the Tunsil trade. You know, the criticism O'Brien got with the Tunsil trade, Seth, was, why didn't you sign him to a deal when you traded for him? You could have done that. He was eligible for an extension. Seattle was not allowed to do that because Clowney was on the franchise tag, and the July 15th deadline to do that by had come and gone. So Seattle, you're right. I think that's the best way to put it, is they purchased an option on Clowney with a third round pick and Jacob Martin. I was just, you know, I got to thinking yesterday, I'm thinking, man, I wonder if Seattle is getting criticized about this at all in Seattle, you know, just, or, you know, John Schneider and Pete Carroll getting criticized because they gave up a third round pick and they gave up Jacob Martin too, who knows, maybe in Anthony Weaver's defense, Jacob Martin takes a step forward this year that makes that trade look better for the Texans. The Texans, of course, flipped that third-round pick they got for Clowney into Gary and Conley, who did some good things for them last year. I actually texted Paul Gallant yesterday, our former colleague here, who's a morning host in Seattle now, just to see what people were saying there. And he said, more than anything, the criticism is, why haven't they re-signed Clowney? He said, yeah. He said other psychopathic 12s, which I guess is what they call their fans there for the 12th man. So Paul's already getting into the lingo there. Other psychopathic 12 say good riddance to Clowney, even though the team's pass rush is bleep right now.
Well, yeah. I don't think they're called the psychopathic 12s. I think that they call them 12s, right? Because they still pay that. They pay a fee to A&M to be able to use the 12th man deal up there.
Right.
I think Paul's saying the psychopathic ones are saying, I don't want them, good riddance.
Saying they're all psychopaths. Yeah. He's saying there's a faction of them that are psychopathic. Yeah.
So I think that's accurate. Like, Clowney was their one pass rushing presence last year, their one dependable pass rushing presence.
Three sacks.
When he was healthy. What's that?
And he had three sacks on the seat. You know, he was their
– Right, right.
Was, and yeah, I know he's more disruptive than that would indicate, but that just goes to show you how bad their pass rush was.
Right, yeah, and a lot of times I think that was the reason he only got three sacks out of it, is that teams could focus on him.
Yeah.
So I think people outside of Seattle think of Pete Carroll and John Schneider differently than people in Seattle do. I think people in Seattle don't trust them all that much in the post Legion of Boom years. For one, Pete Carroll is just like married to running the football, like he's Vince Lombardi in 1963 or something. Yeah. And people just, they're growing tired of that. And then you look at their first round draft picks they've had in the last few years. You know, Jordan Brooks was this year. We'll see. LJ Collier hasn't really done him much. He got LJ Collier, who went to TCU. He's a defensive lineman. He didn't get used much at all. This was his quote this offseason. You didn't have the year you wanted to get, so they just kind of shift you off to the side and say, you can't play. It's disrespectful. I feel very disrespected. Ah. So that's how it's going with him. 2018, Rashad Penny. He had 419 yards rushing in his rookie year, then less last year. Jermaine Ifedi from Texas A&M. He's been average, but that was a first-round pick in 2017. 2014, they had Paul Richardson. So they didn't have any in 15 or 16. 2014, they had Paul Richardson.
The wide receiver, right?
In six seasons, he's had more than 300 yards just once. And then in 2013, Christian Michael from Texas A&M is all. And I'd say this about Christian Michael. People still don't know how to pronounce his name. I'm going to get right now on the text line, I'm going to get 50% of people saying, like, Seth, it's Christian. I went to A&M. I know. And I'm going to get 50% of people that say, Seth, it's Christian. I went to A&M. I know how to pronounce his name.
Well, and here's the thing. It's spelled like Christine.
Yeah, exactly.
it's neither. He's Christine, yeah. Michael in my mind.
Well, there's not an E at the end of it. It makes it a little bit more confusing.
Is it?
But
okay.
One thing I will say, they love him some guys from Texas, do they not?
Yeah, I was just going to say, the scout that has the biggest voice in the room. Seth, there is an E on the end of his name. It's Christine Michael, by God.
Oh, it's Christine Michael.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's not according to – now, people that went to high school with him – have also texted the show. They're going to say something different.
No, I'm sure it's not pronounced Christine, but it sure is spelled like Christine. But yeah, the scout.
No, I did research on this, Sean. I've gone back and looked at various pronunciation guides from places he's been. They're all over the place.
That's funny.
Like, no, I've gone to like the pronunciation guide from A&M and it's Seattle, and it's different every place he's been.
That's funny. Yeah. You're right. The biggest voice in the room, in the war room on draft day, is clearly whatever scout has the state of Texas. Holy crap.
That includes Clowney.
Yeah, you got right. You got a Texas Tech guy last year, TCU, a couple Aggies over the last few years. That's a big voice in the room, man. That's a big voice in the room.
Maybe I better take back what I said about Pete Carroll's ability to evaluate talent.
That's right. All right, so the point with all this is that, no, Texan fans, you can still criticize Bill O'Brien for the Jadeveon Clowney trade. Is that fair to say, Seth?
I think so. Yes, because again, that's a tough one because it's a combo deal between Brian Gain and Bill O'Brien. O'Brien waited too long to trade Jadeveon Clowney. The best value would have been before the draft, but it was Brian Gain's job to do that before the draft. So I'm more inclined to forgive Bill O'Brien just based on the timing of all of that than I am by Clowney's current value. Clowney's current value right now is not as good as it was a year ago today. And that's just the fact of the matter. He was coming off of a better year. I think that people would be poised to maybe do a Frank Clark type of deal that Kansas City did with Seattle. And yet they just waited too long. But that ironically might have been the very thing that Bill O'Brien gets criticized for, the Jadeveon Clowney trade, might have had to happen that way because Brian Gain didn't get it done on time, and that's why Brian Gain was fired.
Yes, that you just hit on what I wanted to mention, which was I think just looking at the optics of Brian Gain being let go, and not only the moves that weren't made, but also look at the subsequent moves that were made, I think it's safe to say that the list includes not moving Clowney before the draft, not being more urgent about getting protection for Deshaun Watson, not using cap space. I mean, Bill O'Brien is deploying cap space, by God. Like, I think Bill O'Brien did not like going into the 2019 season with $50 million in cap space. It's like voluntarily not using resources. I think Bill O'Brien looks at that as like forfeiting draft picks. Not using cap space going into a year. And I'm being serious. Like, I think he's well, why wouldn't we deploy this cap space here to make our team the best that it can possibly be, as long as we're being responsible with it?
Well, that's why, though, I think that Brian Gain had kind of spent 2 years stocking up on all this cap space. So you did have a plethora of it to spend at some point. Okay, you got to spend that money. I say you got to spend it. There's a floor you have to spend. You don't have to spend it. You can let it roll over into the next year. But I think, ideally, hopefully what it was O'Brien saying, look, we've been super conservative for 2 years. You know, even though we messed up on the Aaron Colvin deal and whatnot, we're in good position here. Let's spend that money. And maybe, like when you're spending free agency or what have you, you are inherently, you're overpaying. Like, by definition, you're overpaying because you're paying more than anybody else was willing to pay in free agency. So that he took this year to do it.
Yeah. We're going to do headlines here in just a second. Did you see the headline? I guess it's not so much a headline as it is an observation. First of all, Seth, I haven't watched it yet, but ESPN did like a 1-hour feature on the 10-year anniversary of LeBron James, the decision.
I read an article about how the decision came to be. I didn't watch this show though. I don't know if they're based on the same thing.
Yeah, it's a DVR. Yeah, I think because it's that was an ESPN article that you're talking about. I read it too. And this was an ESPN production, and I think the two kind of supported each other. I think that the article was sort of an overview of the feature that they ran about how the decision came to be and how it was basically the idea of a mailbag entrant to Bill Simmons' old mailbag column that he used to do when he wrote for Page Two on ESPN. That this guy submitted the idea to Simmons, like, hey, when LeBron decides where he's going in free agency, he should make a TV show about it and unveil the decision. Right. And apparently Simmons floated that idea at the All-Star game in 2009 or 2010 to Maverick Carter and Rich Paul. And they went and ran with it, with ESPN. That's a very shortened version of the story, but that was the genesis of it. Some dude from Detroit sent the idea into Bill Simmons' mailbag, and Bill Simmons, behind the scenes, gave it to some people who were influential. And yada, 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 LeBron burned down the entire city of Cleveland in one night.
In defense of Bill Simmons, because halfway through this article, I thought, oh, this is a bad look for Bill Simmons. According to Bill Simmons, and this seems to be backed up by the email records and whatnot, Bill Simmons' thought was, okay, if you are recommitting to Cleveland, then it should be a special. You know, make it a surprise. But that if you're not going back to Cleveland, then that is a dumb idea. So apparently Simmons says that he dropped out a few months before the actual decision, but ESPN and Rich Paul and all these other guys ran with it, obviously.
The show mutated like the virus, right? Like Simmons had a guideline or maybe an overview of what he thought the show should be. And then when he handed it over, it mutated into LeBron essentially going from celebrating Cleveland to having an airborne virus that burnt the entire city and dozens, hundreds, thousands of LeBron jerseys to the ground that night.
It was an outbreak of, but the fact that they ever thought that was a good idea, even though it did raise at least $2 million for the Boys and Girls Club of America, they've got the receipts on that. LeBron's foundation donated that much in that year. It's hard to look back in hindsight and try to put yourself there and think, okay, if I don't know what's going to happen, should I have seen this coming? It feels like pretty obvious, right, that it wouldn't have been received well.
Especially because there was mystery leading up to that night. Yet I think it had been reported, but maybe there was still a little bit of wiggle room that LeBron might go back to Cleveland. But then when he announced the iconic phrase, Seth, I'm taking my talents to South Beach. People ever since then have always, any sort of announcement that's made about people's future plans, they somewhat jokingly now say, I'm taking my talents there because of LeBron James back in 2010.
Man, ESPN has gone so full in on LeBron James, including there was a documentary. I saw a promo for a documentary about a great athlete, and I can't remember who it was for the life of me. But the promo is mostly LeBron talking about how LeBron can relate to the situation this player was in because that's what it's like for me. And then it was LeBron talking about himself for like 30 seconds.
Yeah.
And text in 713-572-4610. Remind Seth's addled brain of who that was.
LeBron is also still a guy, Seth, who I don't think a lot of people remember. They remember it and that they watched it, but I don't think people think of the decision now when they look at LeBron James first and foremost. In part because he went back to Cleveland and he healed those wounds. He won a title for Cleveland. And of all the people that should forgive him, it's that city. And they seem to have forgiven him. But LeBron is still a guy that when he just tweets about anything relative to what's going on in the world these days, the news outlets all pick it up as if LeBron is an actual news correspondent. You know what I mean?
Like
as if his opinion is one that, wow, we really need to get LeBron James' temperature on this or that. Which is funny because he denounced free speech back when Daryl Morey tweeted his thing about China. So I have a hard time taking LeBron totally seriously when he tweets.
People's
these
lives
things.
Are on the line, Sean. Yeah. Remember that was LeBron was terrified that somehow in Japan the Chinese Gestapo was going to come after him somehow.
Right.
That's They were in Japan. People, like, did he think China and Japan were the same places?
I don't know.
Did he see? Like, I don't even want to go life. Into.
This is probably a good spot to do headlines here, Ben. Okay.
Payne and Pendergast with today's headlines.
All right, we begin with the Major League Baseball season restart. And Seth, we have started to get some names of some players who are going to be opting out of the I say restart. The MLB season is actually the start of the season. The NBA is the restart. So we'll start with the Major League Baseball players who are opting out. The biggest names, Ryan Zimmerman and Joe Ross of the Washington Nationals, opting out of the 2020 season delayed by the COVID pandemic for the, quote, personal health and safety of themselves and their loved ones. Now, Zimmerman's an older player. He's 35, the first draft pick in the history of the Nationals portion of the franchise's history after they moved there from Montreal. Zimmerman said in a statement, after a great deal of thought and given my family circumstances, three young children, including a newborn and a mother at high risk, I've decided not to participate in the 2020 season. Ian Desmond of the Rockies, Seth, Mike Leake, a pitcher for the Diamondbacks. These are the only names I've seen so far, so that's four players so far who, for a variety of reasons, have opted out of the 2020 baseball season. So
there are, I think there will be more. It's not going to reach epidemic level proportions. And then I just said it anyway. I don't think that this is, much like the guys retiring early for concussions, it's a very real and valid medical concern. Yeah. But it doesn't mean that because a few guys do it, all of a sudden there's going to be a deluge of guys that do it. I think that there are, just like when guys retire early because they're concerned about their brain health, there are valid concerns right now with how, I think, even younger people who very, very rarely die from it, we're not exactly clear what the potential long-term ramifications are if you get really sick from it. Because there are a lot of young people that do get really sick from it. They just don't end up in an ICU. And if it is affecting your lungs, does it have long-term damage? I think it's understandable that a lot of these guys, aside from worrying about their families and everything, just worrying about themselves personally, if they sit out this year and then know that their lungs will be completely fine next year, I get that. Personally, yeah. I'd be playing, and I think most guys will feel that way, but I get bowing out.
Yeah, I understand it. I don't begrudge the guys who are bowing out. They've got valid reasons to do it, and valid reasons can be, I'm just nervous about playing. That's a valid reason. If they're just nervous about playing, they're not going to get paid, and that's what comes with it. We should mention as well, Seth, team workouts begin on Friday this week. And noting here locally that the core group of the 60-man roster for the Astros, they will be working out at Minute Maid Park, whereas a majority of the players who are not going to be on the 30-man portion of the 60-man roster, the part that actually plays in Major League games to start the season later in July, they will be working out at the University of Houston. So measures, Seth, already being taken to try to socially distance within the team by taking several of the younger players or the fringe players and putting them in a completely different facility than the guys who are going to break camp on July 24th.
I saw that I saw one science writer talk about how, you know, team sports are obviously the exact opposite of social distancing. So you try to create these bubbles. So at least people are only bumping up against each other within this bubble. And then the next step is creating bubbles within the bubbles, right? Trying to create as much. So yeah. I think that it makes sense. I think as much like partitions, both physically and metaphorically, that you can create between human beings right now, then the better. So, yeah, good job, Astros.
Well, and I think as you and I pointed out yesterday, I like that they're keeping Forrest Whitley at the camp over at the University of Houston and not at Minute Maid Park with all the players that really matter.
Forrest Whitley's the guy
that makes us nervous right now.
Might be him, it might be somebody else, but you know there's one jackass on every team that just is so unaware of what he's doing at any given time that he might infect the whole squad you forfeit a week, 2 weeks worth of games.
We should stick with players opting out of their respective seasons here as we continue with headlines on Payne and Pendergast on Sports Radio 610. And just shift to basketball for a moment, and probably the biggest name so far to opt out of the NBA season was DeAndre Jordan of the Brooklyn Nets, who was the prize in free agency a few years ago. If you remember, he jilted the Dallas Mavericks at the altar in free agency a few years back. He is actually tested positive for the coronavirus, and he is not going to participate in the restart of the NBA season. Seth, the Brooklyn Nets are a playoff team as of right now in the East. They are the 7th seed. It's going to take a lot for them to fall out of the playoffs, if I'm not mistaken. I don't have the standings in front of me. But the East only has one other non-playoff team playing right now. It's the Washington Wizards, and they are well back of the 8th seed. So the Nets are probably going to be a playoff team. they were already playing without Kyrie Irving and Kevin Durant, who Durant was going to miss the entire season with the Achilles. Kyrie Irving hurt his shoulder, and he's been done for the year for a while now. But this DeAndre Jordan's the third Brooklyn Net to opt out for the season. He joins Wilson Chandler. And Spencer Dinwiddie, another one who has tested positive for the coronavirus, doesn't look like he's going to play. So the Nets are going to be a playoff team that are essentially missing what probably would have been their starting lineup to come into the season had all five of these guys been healthy. That's wild.
I was a little bit confused by it. So DeAndre Jordan tested positive and then decided to bow out.
Correct.
When he would presumably, as it looks like in most cases, have at least a few months worth of immunity from the coronavirus. That's interesting, Sean.
Yeah.
That's the one I'm genuinely curious about because maybe the ordeal was so bad and ugly for him that he just doesn't want to take the risk of doing it again. I have no idea.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned that, you know, some people feel this disease, this virus differently than others do. We don't know what the long-term effect is. Maybe some of these guys who've tested positive are quietly concerned about the long-term effect, especially in a sport, Seth, that to me, even more than baseball and football, involves cardio and respiratory and running up and down the court. It's a more strenuous sport from a cardio standpoint than those other two sports, and this is a disease that hits the lungs pretty hard.
Yeah, found out, his tweet, DeAndre Jordan's tweet was, found out last night and confirmed again today that I've tested positive for COVID while being back in market. As a result of this, I will not be in Orlando for the resumption of the season. I guess that's just where I was a little bit confused perhaps about exactly what his statement meant. Does that mean that did he mean that he wouldn't be there at the beginning of training camp or the resumption of the season versus not being there at all?
Now that's a fair question. I was reading his tweet to mean that he's not going, but maybe if he's going, maybe he's waiting to go and he'll be there in 3 weeks once he's been quarantined. That's a fair point. I was reading his post to mean that he's just opting out, but it would make sense. I mean, to me, it would be more likely that if he were to quarantine, stay isolated for a few weeks, and join his teammates down in Orlando, right?
Right.
That would seem to make more sense. Okay.
And like, he just tested positive. Obviously, he's out of commission for a couple weeks at least. Then maybe if he's genuinely sick, maybe it's a little bit of a recovery. So I haven't seen any articles that adequately address this, and it's annoying me, Sean.
Yeah. How about we shift gears over to the Texans offering an olive branch to season ticket holders, Seth? Let's do that. We'll get out of the COVID COVID withdrawals of players. The Texans sent an email out to season ticket holders yesterday evening. I know this because I'm married to one. And the email to the season ticket holders essentially offers season ticket holders a few options for what they can do for the upcoming season. And this is the first sign from the Texans business side overtly to people that are spending money on tickets that there may not be a season, but there may not be fans in the stands, or that the coronavirus is certainly impacting people's, at the very least, their buying decisions on season tickets. The Texans offered the options of the following. One, stick it out, hang on, see if there's a 2020 season, and just sit by and hang on to your season tickets. Make your payments and continue to proceed, which is what the NFL has by and large done this offseason. Number two, you can request out of your season tickets for 2020. Keep your seats for subsequent seasons. Keep your PSL. And you can get a refund on what you've paid so far. And in the case of our household, Amy has paid about 3/4 of what her season tickets cost. She has 2 season tickets in the bullpen. Or you can forfeit your tickets for this year, pick it up in 2021, and take whatever you've spent on season tickets and apply it as a credit towards next year and get a nice little 10% bump as a voucher for food and drink next season as well. Amy chose the third of those three choices. She bumped all her money to 2021 because she still likes going to games. She's just not sure about going to games in 2020. But I think, Seth, this could be a sign that the Texans are maybe looking at the possibility of half-full stadiums as mandated by the government, and that they're maybe trying to let season ticket holders voluntarily thin themselves out as opposed to having to go through some sort of matrix to figure out who gets to go to games if it's a 50% capacity deal.
Right, and that's a risky game of That's a risky game of chance on the Texans' part, but it's one that they have to take. I mean, everybody, like all these owners in every professional league are having to deal with a whole lot more risk than they had really kind of built into their calculations before. Yeah. So ideally for them, I'm guessing, I wonder if the Texans are hoping that 75% of people just push it towards next year and that 25% capacity will be what's allowed this year, and you know, or maybe it's 50%. So I'm guessing, and this is a complete guess on my part, that they're hoping somewhere between 25% and 50% of people decide to opt in for this year.
Yeah,
and then that way they'll. But that's your risk right now. In one hand, you've got the chance of watching games this year, and the other hand, it's the chance of losing out on all that. Like if you opt in, you could watch those games this year. If you're allowed in, if no fans are allowed in at all, then you're out. Like Amy would be out all that money on her season tickets this year.
Well, I think the Texans are still going to refund those people. I don't think they're going to keep or apply the tickets to next year. You know what I mean? Like I don't think the Texans are going to go too bad. So sad there were no games. We're keeping your $3,000.
Okay. But this just allows people to just instead of spending that money. Okay.
You know all what right. I mean? Like I think the option of staying in means I still want to go to games this year.
Yeah.
Whereas Amy, by opting out, is saying, I don't want to go to games, but I want to be a season ticket holder a year from now, you know, in 2021.
If that's the case, and if I read it, I don't think there's been a guarantee that you're going to get your money back there.
No.
You know, so it's not guaranteed, but I then personally, Sean, knowing that, I would say I would opt in for this year because if only 25% of fans are allowed in the stadium, your ticket is going to be worth so much for the Patriots game or the Green Bay game or any of those games where only 15,000 to 20,000 tickets are available.
Yep.
So you could, if you want to recoup your investment, you can just sell one of those.
You could. Now, that's a risky proposition even in a normal season. But you're right. Your supply and demand. If there's less supply of those tickets, making those games matter. Yes, that is a gamble that some people are going to make. Seth, I think you and I are lucky. We're still working. We're still getting paid. I think that the Texans, what they're doing here, recognizes the reality that there is probably a large chunk of their season ticket base that needs that $2,000 back. You know, just from a cash flow standpoint, you know, they've paid $2,000, $3,000 for 75% of their cost of season tickets, and they did it before the pandemic hit, or they did it when they still had a job. And now they're offering this olive branch to folks who forget about the fact that, maybe the Patriot game or the Packer game or whatever, or the Raven game are going to be worth a lot of money. I got to pay my bills. And this is $3,000 I'm getting back that I hadn't been really counting on necessarily.
So this is the Houston Texans Stimulus Act in giving you your own money back.
Right.
This is how I'm going to frame it.
Right.
Seth Payne, the coronavirus commissioner of Harris County, is going to try to sell to you the fan that I'm giving you your money back.
Yeah.
I advocated for this, and I'm the one that thinks that this money that I'm giving you, I'm going to sign my name on the check and everything.
It's the same exact thing, except they lopped off three sets of zeros on it. Instead of $2 trillion, it's $2,000. Yeah, same exact thing.
But still,
thing.
Is how much, like, in terms of the individual check you're getting, kind of similar.
Oh, that's true. Yeah, you're right. You're right. It's almost the exact same.
That's why I said it.
A dependent or two. Yeah. So there you go. So that's and Stephanie Stradley put a poll up about this. The winner of the poll, as far as people voting on what they would do, take the credit and apply it to next year and get a lot of that free food and drink that they're giving you with to do that, to hang on to your money. All right, Ben, we can take the music down. That was Headlines.
What up, y'all? It's your boy Danny Green, three-time NBA champ. You either rooted for me or rooted against me. Join myself and my co-host Harrison Sanford on the Inside the Green Room podcast.
It's a podcast that brings you never-before-told tales from the locker room to candid interviews with basketball legends to breakdowns of what's happening in the NBA right now. Whether you're a diehard fan or casual about your hoops, this podcast brings you the game like never before.
Follow Inside the Green Room on the Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.